Chapter 24. The Jew has his other side. He has some discreditable ways, though he is not a monopoly of them, because he cannot get entirely rid of vexatious Christian competition. We have seen that he seldom transgresses the laws against crimes of violence. Indeed, his dealings with courts are almost restricted to matters connected with commerce. He has a reputation for various small forms of cheating, and for practicing oppressive usury, and for burning himself out to get the insurance, and for arranging cunning contracts which leave him an exit, but lock the other man in, and for smart evasions which find him safe and comfortable just within the strict letter of the law, when court and jury know very well that he has violated the spirit of it. He is a frequent and faithful and capable officer in the civil service, but he is charged with an unpatriotic disinclination to stand by the flag as a soldier like the Christian Quaker. Now if you offset these discreditable features by the creditable ones summarized in a preceding paragraph beginning with the words, "These facts are all on the credit side," apostrophe and strike a balance, what must the verdict be? This, I think. That, the merits and demerits being fairly weighed and measured on both sides, the Christian can claim no superiority over the Jew in the matter of good citizenship. Yet in all countries, from the dawn of history, the Jew has been persistently and implacably hated, and with frequency persecuted. Point number 2. Can fanaticism alone account for this? Apostrophe, years ago I used to think that it was responsible for nearly all of it, but latterly I have come to think that this was an error. Indeed, it is now my conviction that it is responsible for hardly any of it. In this connection I call to mind Genesis, chapter 5. We have all thoughtfully or unthoughtfully read the pathetic story of the years of plenty, and the years of famine in Egypt, and how Joseph, with that opportunity, made a corner in broken hearts, and the crusts of the poor, and human liberty a corner whereby he took a nation's money all away, to the last penny, took a nation's livestock all away, to the last hoof, took a nation's land away, to the last acre, then took the nation itself, buying it for bread, man by man, woman by woman, child by child, till all were slaves, a corner which took everything, left nothing, a corner so stupendous that, by comparison with it, the most gigantic corners in subsequent history are but baby things, for it dealt in hundreds of millions of bushels, and its profits were reckonable by hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was a disaster, so crushing that its effects have not wholly disappeared from Egypt today, more than 3,000 years after the event. Is it presumably that the eye of Egypt was upon Joseph the foreign Jew all this time? I think it likely. Was it friendly? We must doubt it. Was Joseph establishing a character for his race which would survive long in Egypt? And in time would his name come to be familiarly used to express that character like Shylock's? It is hardly to be doubted. Let us remember that this was centuries before the crucifixion. I wish to come down 1800 years later and refer to a remark made by one of the Latin historians. I read it in a translation many years ago, and it comes back to me now with force. It was alluding to a time when people were still living who could have seen the Savior in the flesh. Christianity was so new that the people of Rome had hardly heard of it, and had but confused notions of what it was. The substance of the remark was this. Some Christians were persecuted in Rome through error, they being mistaken for Jews. ... The meaning seems plain. These pagans had nothing against Christians, but they were quite ready to persecute Jews. For some reason or other they hated a Jew, before they even knew what a Christian was. May I not assume, then, that the persecution of Jews is a thing which antedates Christianity, and was not born of Christianity? I think so. What was the origin of the feeling? When I was a boy, in the back settlements of the Mississippi Valley, where a gracious and beautiful Sunday school simplicity and practicality prevailed, the Yankee citizen of the New England states was hated with a splendid energy. But religion had nothing to do with it. In the trade, the Yankee was held to be about five times the match of the Westerner. His shrewdness, his insight, his judgment, his knowledge, his enterprise, and his formidable cleverness in applying these forces were frankly confessed, and most competently cursed. In the cotton states, after the war, the simple and ignorant Negroes made the crops for the white planter on shares. The Jew came down in force, set up shop on the plantation, supplied all the Negroes' wants on credit, and at the end of the season, was proprietor of the Negroes' share of the present crop, and of part of his share of the next one. Before long, the whites detested the Jew, and it is doubtful if the Negro loved him. The Jew is again legislated out of Russia. The reason is not concealed. The movement was instituted because the Christian peasant and villager stood no chance against his commercial abilities. He was always ready to lend money on a crop, and sell vodka and other necessities of life on credit, while the crop was growing. When settlement day came, he owned the crop, and next year after he owned the farm, like Joseph. In the dull and ignorant English of John's time, everybody got into debt to the Jew. He gathered all lucrative enterprises into his hands. He was the king of commerce. He was ready to be helpful in all profitable ways. He even financed crusades for the rescue of the sepulcher. To wipe out his account with the nation and restore business to its natural and incompetent channels, he had to be banished the realm. For the like reason, Spain had to banish him 400 years ago, and Austria about a couple of centuries later. In all the ages, Christian Europe has been obliged to curtail his activities. If he entered upon a mechanical trade, the Christian had to retire from it. If he set up as a doctor, he was the best one, and he took the business. If he exploited agriculture, the other farmers had to get at something else. Since there was no way to successfully compete with him in any vocation, the law had to step in and save the Christian from the poorhouse. Trade after trade was taken away from the Jew by statute till practically none was left. He was forbidden to engage in agriculture. He was forbidden to practice law. He was forbidden to practice medicine, except among Jews. He was forbidden the handicrafts. Even the seats of learning and the schools of science had to be closed against this tremendous antagonist. Still, almost bereft of employments, he found ways to make money, even ways to get rich. Also ways to invest his takings well, for usury was not denied him. In the hard conditions suggested, the Jew without brains could not survive, and the Jew with brains had to keep them in good training and well sharpened up, or starve. Ages of restriction to the one tool which the law was not able to take from him, his brain, have made that tool singularly competent. Ages of compulsory disuse of his hands have atrophied them, and he never uses them now. This history has a very, very commercial look, a most sordid and practical commercial look, the business aspect of a Chinese cheap labor crusade. Religious prejudices may account for one part of it, but not for the other nine. Protestants have persecuted Catholics, but they did not take their livelihoods away from them. The Catholics have persecuted the Protestants with bloody and awful bitterness, but they never closed agriculture and the handicrafts against them. Why was that? That has the candid look of genuine religious persecution, not a trade union boycott in a religious dispute. The Jews are harried and obstructed in Austria and Germany, and lately in France, but England and America give them an open field and yet survive. Scotland offers them an unembarrassed field too, but there are not many takers. There are a few Jews in Glasgow, and one in Aberdeen, but that is because they can't earn enough to get away. The Scotch pay themselves that compliment, but it is authentic. I feel convinced that the crucifixion has not much to do with the world's attitude toward the Jew, that the reasons for it are older than that event, as suggested by Egypt's experience, and by Rome's regret for having persecuted an unknown quantity called a Christian, under the mistaken impression that she was merely persecuting a Jew. Merely a Jew, a skin deal who was used to it, presumably. I am persuaded that in Russia, Austria, and Germany 9/10 of the hostility to the Jew comes from the average Christian's inability to compete successfully with the average Jew in business, in either straight business or the questionable sort. In Berlin, a few years ago, I read a speech which frankly urged the expulsion of the Jews from Germany, and the agitator's reason was as frank as his proposition. It was this: that 85% of the successful lawyers of Berlin were Jews, and that about the same percentage of the great and lucrative businesses of all sorts in Germany were in the hands of the Jewish race. Isn't it an amazing confession? It was but another way of saying that in a population of 48,000,000, of whom only 500,000 were registered as Jews, 85% of the brains and honesty of the whole was lodged in the Jews. I must insist upon the honesty. It is an essential of successful business, taken by and large. Of course, it does not rule out rascals entirely, even among Christians, but it is a good working rule, nevertheless. The speaker's figures may have been inexact, but the motive of persecution stands out as clear as day. The man claimed that in Berlin the banks, the newspapers, the theaters, the great mercantile, shipping, mining, and manufacturing interests, the big army and city contracts, the tramways, and pretty much all other properties of high value, and also the small businesses, were in the hands of the Jews. He said the Jew was pushing the Christian to the wall all along the line, that it was all a Christian could do to scrape together a living, and that the Jew must be banished, and soon there was no other way of saving the Christian. Here in Vienna, last autumn, an agitator said that all these disastrous details were true of Austria-Hungary also, and in fierce language he demanded the expulsion of the Jews. When politicians come out without a blush, and read the Baby Act in this frank way, unrebuked, it is a very good indication that they have a market back of them, and nowhere to fish for votes. You note the crucial point of the mentioned agitation. The argument is that the Christian cannot compete with the Jew, and that hence his very bread is in peril. To human beings this is a much more hate-inspiring thing than is any detail connected with religion. With most people, of a necessity, bread and meat take first rank, religion second. I am convinced that the persecution of the Jew is not due in any large degree to religious prejudice. No, the Jew is a money-getter, and in getting his money he is a very serious obstruction to less capable neighbors who are on the same quest. I think that that is the trouble. In estimating worldly values, the Jew is not shallow, but deep. With precocious wisdom he found out in the morning of time that some men worship rank, some worship heroes, some worship power, some worship God, and that over these ideals they dispute and cannot unite, but that they all worship money. So he made it the end, a aim of his life to get it. He was at it in Egypt 36 centuries ago. He was at it in Rome, when that Christian got persecuted by mistake for him. He has been at it ever since. The cost to him has been heavy. His success has made the whole human race his enemy, but it has paid, for it has brought him envy, and that is the only thing which men will sell both soul and body to get. He long ago observed that a millionaire commands respect, a two-millionaire homage, a multi-millionaire the deepest deeps of adoration. We all know that feeling. We have seen it express itself. We have noticed that when the average man mentions the name of a multi-millionaire, he does it with that mixture in his voice of awe and reverence and lust which burns in a Frenchman's eye when it falls on another man's centime. Point number 4, the Jews have no party. They are non-participants. apostrophe, perhaps you have let the secret out and given yourself away. It seems hardly a credit to the race that it is able to say that, or to you, sir, that you can say it without remorse. More, that you should offer it as a plea against maltreatment, injustice, and oppression. Who gives the Jew the right, who gives any race the right, to sit still in a free country and let somebody else look after its safety? The oppressed Jew was entitled to all pity in the former times under brutal autocracies, for he was weak and friendless, and had no way to help his case. But he has ways now, and he has had them for a century, but I do not see that he has tried to make serious use of them. When the revolution set him free in France, it was an act of grace, the grace of other people. He does not appear in it as a helper. I do not know that he helped when England set him free. Among the 12 sane men of France who have stepped forward with great Zola at their head to fight and win, I hope and believe, 3, the battle for the most infamously misused Jew of modern times, do you find a great, or richer illustrious Jew helping? In the United States he was created free in the beginning, he did not need to help, of course. In Austria and Germany and France he has a vote, but of what considerable use is it to him? He doesn't seem to know how to apply it to the best effect. With all his splendid capacities and all his fat wealth, he is today not politically important in any country. In America, as early as 1854, the ignorant Irish hod carrier, who had a spirit of his own, and a way of exposing it to the weather, made it apparent to all that he must be politically reckoned with. Yet 15 years before, that we hardly knew what an Irishman looked like. As an intelligent force and numerically, he has always been a way down, but he has governed the country just the same. It was because he was organized. It made his vote valuable, in fact, essential. You will say the Jew is everywhere numerically feeble. That is nothing to the point with the Irishman's history for an object lesson. But I am coming to your numerical feebleness presently. In all parliamentary countries you could no doubt elect Jews to the legislatures, and even one member in such a body is sometimes a force which counts. How deeply have you concerned yourselves about this in Austria, France, and Germany? Or even in America, for that matter? You remark that the Jews were not to blame for the riots in this Reichsrat here, and you add with satisfaction that there wasn't one in that body. That is not strictly correct. If it were, would it not be in order for you to explain it and apologize for it, not try to make a merit of it? But I think that the Jew was by no means in as large force there as he ought to have been, with his chances. Austria opens the suffrage to him on fairly liberal terms, and it must surely be his own fault that he is so much in the background politically. As to your numerical weakness, I mentioned some figures a while ago, 500,000 as the Jewish population of Germany. I will add some more, 600,000 in Russia, 5,000,000 in Austria, 250,000 in the United States. I take them from memory. I read them in the Encyclopedia Britannica 10 or 12 years ago. Still, I am entirely sure of them. If those statistics are correct, my argument is not as strong as it ought to be as concerns America, but it still has strength. It is plenty strong enough as concerns Austria, for 10 years ago 500,000 was 9% of the empire's population. The Irish would govern the kingdom of heaven if they had a strength there like that. I have some suspicions. I got them at second hand, but they have remained with me these 10 or 12 years. When I read in the E.B. that the Jewish population of the United States was 250,000, I wrote the editor and explained to him that I was personally acquainted with more Jews than that in my country, and that his figures were without a doubt a misprint for 25,000,000. I also added that I was personally acquainted with that many there, but that was only to raise his confidence in me, for it was not true. His answer miscarried, and I never got it. But I went around talking about the matter, and people told me they had reason to suspect that for business reasons many Jews whose dealings were mainly with the Christians did not report themselves as Jews in the census. It looked plausible. It looks plausible yet. Look at the city of New York, and look at Boston, and Philadelphia, and New Orleans, and Chicago, and Cincinnati, and San Francisco, how your race swarms in those places. And everywhere else in America, down to the least little village. Read the signs on the marts of commerce, and on the shops. Goldstein, Goldstone, Edelstein, Precious Stone, Blumenthal, Flower Veil, Rosenthal, Rose-Veil, Volchendoft, Violent Odor, Singvigil, Songbird, Rosenzweig, Rose Branch, and all the amazing list of beautiful and enviable names which Prussia and Austria glorified you with so long ago. It is another instance of Europe's coarse and cruel persecution of your race. Not that it was coarse and cruel to outfit it with pretty and poetical names like those, but it was coarse and cruel to make it pay for them, or else take such hideous and often indecent names that today their owners never use them, or, if they do, only on official papers. And it was the many, not the few, who got the odious names, they being too poor to bribe the officials to grant them better ones. Now why was the race renamed? I have been told that in Prussia it was given to using fictitious names, and often changing them, so as to beat. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.